Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Viagogo, Apple and Michael Jackson. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I was just drinking some coffee there. I have noticed on recent podcasts, but I think it's only notable because I know and I'm listening very intently on some good headphones, that sometimes during your intro, you can actually hear me slurping coffee in the background as I try and get a mouthful of coffee before we start.
People are going to listen out for that now.
They're going to be listening extra intently. I wonder how many people will rewind now to see if they can hear me slurping my coffee.
I reckon no one.
No one will do that.
It's not that interesting.
Nobody is committed enough. That's the problem. We've got the air conditioning on today because it's quite warm in this studio. It's been quite warm in general, hasn't it, in recent weeks?
No.
In this United Kingdom.
It's been cold.
The last week has been famously hot and full of thunderstorms as a result. Have you not been paying attention to either the news, the weather, or the world around you?
Not the news. I try to avoid the news, but the weather, yeah, and the world around me, yeah.
And it has been quite hot and quite thundery.
Thunder and lightning and, yeah, all of that.
So we have the AC on here.
It's almost like it's summer.
I did an interview the other day with a Turkish news station.
You decided to do that then?
In London.
Yeah.
On their arts programme.
Yeah.
Talking about the old Sony ATV EMI thing that we talked about on last week's set list.
Yeah.
And their offices in central London. The actual office bit was really nice and air conditioned. But then the studio, which was sort of overlooking Oxford Street, I think, didn't seem to have any air conditioning and quite a lot of kit in. So it was really warm. So I sort of rushed to get there, walked up the stairs, then walked through this really nice AC bit and then into this studio. And then it took a few minutes while they, because the interviewer was actually, I assume, in Istanbul interviewing me through a headphone. And as I was sitting there waiting, I just realised I was sort of really starting to sweat in a sort of noticeable way. And my forehead was becoming damp. And it's like, well, this is going to look great when they go live. And they got this guy from London talking about the Sony EMI deal, looking like a sweaty, hot mess in a little cupboard in London. So that's how my week went.
It's good. I'm going to trawl YouTube for that.
It is actually on YouTube. They sent me a link, but I didn't watch it. Because as you know, I love the sound of my own voice. I can listen to this podcast for weeks on end. And when I do interviews on The World Service or Radio 5, love that. Can't stand watching myself, even when I'm not in a hot, sweaty little room. So yeah, I've not watched the clip, although I was sent the link. But I'm not sending it to you.
I will find it.
You will find it.
And I will put it in the show notes for
You'll
this show.
You'll put it in the show notes. How very embarrassing. Hey, I'm going to Cannes.
Well, it says in the show notes, also mentioned, I've got to put it in now.
I'm going to Cannes next
week.
I'm
going to embed it.
Embed it actually into the page.
I'm going to embed it where we normally put the podcast.
I am assuming that no one ever looks at the show notes, so it doesn't matter.
They do. They all do.
That is my assumption here.
They will now.
So I'm going to Cannes next week, he says for the third time.
What?
That sort of links, because I'm assuming it's going to be hot. Is it going to be hot in Cannes in June? Should be, surely.
You'd think.
By the sea. It is MIDEM next week, and for the first time ever, I'm sort of going pretty much for the whole thing. I can't quite remember why I decided to do that. I think it was because they were offering me free hotel rooms, and they said, well, how many nights are you coming for? And I said, how many nights can I have? And they said, well, we can put you up for 3 nights. Well, I'll have 3 nights without really planning what it was that I was going to be doing. But what I am going to be doing, my official business, is I'm going to be moderating a panel on the Music Modernisation Act.
All right.
Which obviously you have to say, communicating that that's modernisation with a Z, because it's American. So I'll be talking to some people from the American music industry about that piece of legislation that we have talked about at length.
We really have.
On this podcast. Although, actually, it's now gone through to Senate. I assume by the time this podcast goes out, it'll still be stuck in Senate. As you may remember, because we talked about it on set list, this effort to overhaul various aspects of music copyright, music licensing in the US went through the House of Representatives in like record time. As far as I can see, they were like halfway through reading it and everyone went, yeah, we'll pass that. And it was just passed. It's now in Senate.
Music, love it.
Yeah, have whatever you like. It's now in Senate, the upper chamber of the Congress of the United States of America, and a few spanners are being thrown into the works. Well, people are attempting to throw some spanners into the work in Senate. We've not actually been reporting on those spanners because we've been so busy with Great Escape type stuff. I've not had chance to get my head around the spanners. But my task before my panel at MIDEM is to become fully spanner aware. Yeah. And we will be discussing that at Needham. I think it's on the Thursday early afternoon. They put all the panels on YouTube, so you can watch that instead of me sitting in the Turkish sauna talking about EMI. I'm also interviewing Carrie Sherman, who is the CEO of the RIAA. Ugh. I'm not going to talk to him about the name
you
of
his organization. You should. I want that to be the entire interview. Why? Why have you got such a terrible name?
Shall I just go with 20 alternative names?
What do you think of this one?
I've only got 15 minutes, but we could go through.
Plenty of time. I'm sure you can find something better in 15 minutes. I mean, it's longer than I'd say they spent trying to choose it in the first place.
I'm not sure we should be spending this podcast dissing the name of the organisation whose CEO I'm going to be interviewing at Needham on Friday.
Might make it more interesting.
It will be a really interesting conversation. Actually, it sort of links to the previous day's panel. It's all about sort of how the music industry can influence the lawmaking process and where, particularly on the recording side and the copyright side of the music industry, those efforts are important. And in some ways, it will be an interesting follow-on because for all the Music Modernization Act is called the Music Modernization Act. Mm. And everybody who is behind that legislation is saying this is going to be a major once-in-a-lifetime overhaul of American copyright law. But as far as I can see, the outcome of the Music Modernization Act, even if it goes through as currently written, is it will simply bring America up to where the rest of the world already is. It'll just get rid of some of the, not all, but some of the peculiarities of American copyright and bring it more in line with Europe. So it's more of a sort of bringing up to date act, which I suppose is modernization. But there's lots about European copyright law that doesn't really work in the streaming age. And none of that is really being addressed in this act. So maybe when I'm talking to Carrie Sherman, we can talk about, well, what else, assuming the Music Modernization Act goes through, what are the other things that the music industry would like to see reformed?
What does America actually count as the modern age? So is it like, you're starting about 1950, so they're going to bring it up to there. And then they'll start working on the future, which will bring it up to now. Yeah, it's not really that modern at all.
No. So that is what we'll be talking about.
So you'll say, why does your organisation have such a terrible name? And why is this called Music Modernisation when it's not even modern? You're not even trying. Why didn't you try to be modern at all?
These are not the... Well, the Music Modernisation Act has been predominantly pushed by the music publishers, not the record companies.
Oh, well, that explains it then. Although, fair enough.
The record companies have managed to get some of their issues into the legislation, like the stupid pre-1972 malarkey. So there's elements of recording stuff in there as well. But we'll be talking about, okay, beyond the Music Modernization Act, where next? Where next? Well, beyond being modern, being modern's passé in 2018, where next will sort of be the stuff I'm going to be talking about.
Modern, like, you know, modern Amish.
I'm really regretting bringing this up.
All right, I'll make sure. I'll send it to him first.
This is what I'm going to be doing at Needham in Cannes next week, or this week, as you hear the podcast. But I'm also going to be there on Tuesday evening and Wednesday with actually nothing to do. Although I have been invited on the Wednesday to a thing called the Value Gap Lunch. So although I don't have any official activities on Wednesday, I am looking forward to going to the Value Gap Lunch, which I think is on the roof of the building where the conference takes place.
So there'll be a lot of it, it just won't be very expensive.
So I have no idea. So that's what I'm going to be doing. As a result of that, me being in Cannes, being hot and sweaty and talking about the music industry, because of that, next week there won't be a normal edition of Setlist, but there will be another of our CMU is 20 years old. Let's talk about some of the things that happened in the last two decades. Setlist specials.
Yes. This time, are we going to say, or is it a surprise?
Oh, I don't know. We better get on with our stories.
Coming up this week, we've got Apple's non-move into music publishing and the Michael Jackson estate's lawsuit against Disney. But first, a deadline for the four main secondary ticketing sites to adhere to new rules laid down by the Advertising Standards Authority in the UK passed last week. And do you know what? One of those big secondary ticketing sites did not adhere to the rules. Can you guess which one it was? I'll give you four guesses.
Well, there are only four.
Oh, yeah, I know. All right, I'll give you three guesses.
Three guesses.
There you go, Jeopardy.
So I'm
introducing Jeopardy.
There is the possibility that I will get it wrong. I think every single person in the world, well, not every single person in the world, because most people don't care. I mean, the fact this is still an issue, the fact there are still idiots who are buying tickets on Viacoco tells you that most people in the world as yet don't care.
So you guess them.
But surely anyone who listens to this podcast even just in the background and there in the dining room and it's playing in the spare room two stories up, we'll be aware.
Slowly feeds in.
Of which of the big four secondary ticketing platforms has chosen not to comply with the demands of the UK advertising industry regulator that were made 2 months ago. So it is not StubHub.
No.
eBay gets a tick. They have complied with the rules. It is not SeatWave or Get Me In, both owned by Live Nation's Ticketmaster. They have complied with the ASA's demand. However, good old Viacoco apparently said they were gonna.
Yeah.
They said they were gonna.
And saying you're gonna is nearly as good as doing it.
But they didn't.
No, which isn't really a surprise. But yeah, so the ASA made these demands back in March and actually put some extra demands on Viagogo. So it ordered that all four sites start declaring the total cost of tickets up front rather than adding delivery charges, VAT and booking fees right at the end of the transaction. And they've all done that. Except Viagogo. And it also specifically told Viagogo to stop using confusing terms like official and 100% guarantee when promoting tickets for sale on its platform. Because obviously, sellers on the Viagogo platform are in no way official. Viagogo is in no way official. And because, well, as this whole thing with Ed Sheeran tickets in the last week or so, you can't say there's 100% guarantee or even guarantee at all that you will get in, because Ed Sheeran and lots of other artists are now cancelling tickets if they find out they've been sold on secondary platforms.
Yeah, so what Viagogo would say is if you Google Ed Sheeran tickets and you're taken to the Ed Sheeran tickets page on the Viagogo website, which will be the top thing. I mean, unless Google have actually done something about this by the time this podcast goes out. Certainly, when I tried this morning, it was still happening. So you Google Ed Sheeran tickets, the top link will be to Viagogo. It's a paid-for link. And you go to the Ed Sheeran page on the Viagogo site, and it will be talking about official and guarantee. And what Viagogo means is, it's the official Ed Sheeran page on Viagogo.
As opposed to,
yeah. As opposed to them being official approved sellers of tickets. And they'll say, you get our 100% guarantee, which means that when Ed Sheeran cancels the tickets you've just bought, which they almost certainly will, and you don't get in, then you can get your money back from Viagogo. Although anyone who's tried to get their money back from Viagogo will tell you, you can get your money back providing you're quite patient.
And as anyone who looks at our web stats on a daily basis will be able to tell you, there's a lot of people Googling, how do I get a refund from Viagogo? And coming to our website, not Viagogo's website.
Yeah, so as you say, the ASA was the latest in a long line of regulators in the UK and elsewhere in the world to make demands of Viagogo to make it clearer to people buying tickets that they are buying off unofficial touts. The touts like to be called ticket brokers, don't they? But let's call them touts.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've got to be clear that this is not an official seller. It's a tout selling you the ticket. There will be extra charges in addition to the price that ticket's being advertised at, not least the significant fee that Viagogo itself charges. And they should tell you the exact total figure up front and also stop misleading people into thinking that they're somehow official and some sort of guarantee. And so various different regulators and government bodies have been making demands of Viagogo and the others for a while. The ASA was the latest. As you say, they'd set the 26th of May as a deadline for all four to comply, which was weirdly the Saturday of a bank holiday weekend.
It was a strange date.
I don't quite know why. And as we also said, when the ASA put out their statement confirming that the other three had complied and Viagogo had not, they did say in that statement that Viagogo had indicated in the 2 months between it making its demands and the deadline it had set that they were going to comply, but that they had not. And as a result of that, two things are happening. First of all, the ASA have, in essence, reported Viagogo to National Trading Standards, who are already looking into Viagogo's activities. Meanwhile,
they were aware.
Perhaps more importantly, the ASA and various ad agencies and ad platforms are looking into what sanctions they should take themselves in order to, I guess, punish Viagogo for not following these rules, or, depending on how you look at it, to protect consumers who are going on the web looking to buy tickets for gigs.
Maybe both. And that could be the thing that knocks Viagogo off its fairly cocky perch, because up till now it's been kind of gleefully ignoring anyone who tells it to stop doing what it's doing. You know, they refuse to turn up to a select committee. You know, once you turn up to a select committee, you can kind of go, well, I'm just going to ignore everyone now. But the big part of their business is putting a lot of money into Google Ads, making sure you get your link up top that says, this is the official place to buy Ed Sheeran tickets. Buy them here, 100% guarantee you'll get in, honest, it's fine. And if, say, Google were to say, right, that's it, with, you know, all these bodies have said, you're not playing by the rules, we're not going to take your money, we're not going to let you advertise, then that is really going to knock Viagogo's business, and it would actually probably have to do something.
Yeah, and of course, amongst the various people who have been making demands of second ticketing sites in recent months are Google itself, who late last year announced a new set of Google rules, which are applying the Google platform worldwide, which was making similar demands of sites like Viagogo as the Advertising Standards Authority, as various government institutions, indeed as current consumer rights law here in the UK demands. And the ultimate penalty of not following Google's rules was that Google would refuse to start taking your money. And so, well, it sort of feels like the time has come that Google's got to make good on that commitment.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, no one likes turning down easy cash. And you assume, because usually...
I do.
You turn down easy cash all the time.
Constantly.
Well, that's why you're stuck in this room talking about music business nonsense and not off, I don't know, on a cruise
but
somewhere.
But I've never advertised Viagogo.
But you've never advertised Viagogo, although we talk about them all the time.
That's true.
Albeit negatively, yeah, but there's no such thing as bad publicity. Mm. But it probably is time for Google to finally make good on its commitment and to stop taking Viagogo's money so that, as you say, when people go to Google search and they Google Ed Sheeran tickets, no longer will the Viagogo page appear at the top of the search list. We also are under the impression that the ASA is planning on running its own ads. I don't know whether it buys those or whether Google donate them. I don't know. But basically having its own ads, I don't quite know what they're going to say, but something along the lines of, do not buy from Viagogo or something similar. And we do know that Google and the ASA are very much talking to each other on this. So although Google have their own rules, they are also very much paying attention to what the advertising industry regulator is saying. So it could be that we do actually see some action happening here. So whether or not that is Viagogo at the very last minute complying with these rules, certainly within the UK, or whether it is Google actually saying, right, that's it, no more Viagogo adverts on Google. Obviously, that doesn't stop Viagogo from existing, but you do feel that a lot of people, certainly the sorts of people who are not savvy enough to know that there's a big risk buying tickets from Viagogo, those sorts of people are the sorts of people who, when they decide they want to go and see an Ed Sheeran show, not just Ed Sheeran shows, anybody's show, go to Google, Google Ed Sheeran tickets, and then end up on the Viagogo platform without really realising what they are doing. So it does feel like that one act by Google, and of course the other search engines, but I mean in the UK, there aren't really any other search engines that anyone uses. But if Google would do that, then it could be that you start to see some sort of tangible changes occurring. So we await with interest to see what Google and the ASA and the advertising industry at large and national trading standards do about this. Imagine if nothing now happens. If Viagogo call everyone's bluff and it kind of works. I mean,
well, that's how it's gone. That's how it's worked so far.
If it does work again this time, it sort of gets to the point where that's kind of impressive.
Yeah.
And fair game to them. But we'll see whether or not Google actually do something and whether or not we might even get to the point where we stop talking about Viagogo on Setlist.
Still to come, some news in brief, plus the Michael Jackson estate suing Disney for copyright infringement. But now, there was a big flurry of excitement on the internet last week when people decided that Apple was setting up a music publishing company, which seemed to be the result of numerous websites that don't really know what music publishing is, reporting on a slightly misleading report that they'd only half read.
Yeah, the actual news that emerged last week, that then lots of sort of tech sites and news and business sites were sort of not quite properly reporting on, was that Apple has promoted one of its long-term executives who has worked there for a number of years now, in fact, I think more than 10 years, on the iTunes side of the business, predominantly working in a legal role. So that's Eleanor Siegel. She has got a brand new job at Apple, which is Global Director of Music Publishing.
Which, to be fair, is a misleading job title.
It's a slightly misleading job title. So basically, they're setting up a new team within Apple Music, the Apple streaming service, to manage Apple's relationships and Apple Music's relationships with the music publishers and the songwriters and everyone who works on the sort of the song copyright publishing side of the business. So she is going to be split between the UK and the US, and she's going to have a team of people who are going to be in charge of all of those publisher and songwriter relations. So that is what has happened. But I suppose, as you say, because of the slightly misleading job title, various people were thinking that this is Apple becoming a music publisher.
Which that is not the case. I mean, however rightly or wrongly the story was reported, I mean, it was reported as a massive deal. But really, is Apple getting to this kind of thing really quite late? I mean, Spotify has been doing songwriter relations for quite a long time in a bid to get songwriters to stop moaning about it. And obviously that's gone massively well. What with the, you know, the multiple lawsuits brought against it by songwriters and publishers.
Albeit mainly in America.
Yes.
Whereas I think elsewhere in the world, songwriters do have a better relationship with Spotify. Yeah, I mean, obviously Spotify's been going a lot longer than Apple Music.
True, but Apple's been in music quite a long time, or digital music for a long time, and was well aware of the pitfalls of digital music through the iTunes store. I mean, Apple Music really could have launched with artist and songwriter relations from the beginning, rather than, you know, lump going, oh, all right, well, I guess we'll do that however many years later.
Generally speaking, digital music setups, including the streaming services, don't tend to have quite so close relationships with the songwriting publishing side of music as they do with labels and artists. And there are various reasons for that. Some relate to licensing stuff. As you'll know if you read Dissecting the Digital Dollar, that excellent book that
put a link in the show notes,
you can link
underneath
to
the video of you sweating on Turkish telly.
Underneath the video of me sweating on the telly. But yes, when it comes to the way streaming services are licensed, it's actually quite common that when it comes to the song copyright that the songwriters and publishers control, that the collecting societies, the PRSs and gamers and SASMs of this world, tend to do the deal, process the data and the money. So between the publishers and the writers and the services is a big collecting society. Even where you do have music publishers licensing directly, so the big five and some of the bigger indies now do license their Anglo-American repertoires to services like Apple Music directly. But even where you do have those direct deals, it's not quite the same as when Apple does deals with labels, because when you do a deal with a publisher, you do the deal, and then all that happens every month is you send a load of data off to the publisher or the society, they send back an invoice and you pay them. Whereas obviously on the label side, well, there is that kind of transaction going on as well. As soon as you're in business with a record company, they are then, in essence, connecting with you on an almost daily basis. You know, at least once a week, they're pushing actual new content into your servers. Then their marketing teams are pitching at your playlisters and trying to get coverage on your platform. So you have a much more active relationship with the record companies and therefore with the artists that the record companies represent, whereas that doesn't tend to happen so much on the publishing and songwriter side, which I think is why when you find people in the music community who are still of a streaming is bad, we're all doomed, we should shut down streaming mindset, it does tend to be more on the songwriter-publisher side, which is why Spotify did put all that effort in a few years ago to setting up a songwriter and publisher relations team. And presumably that is why Apple Music, as you say, somewhat late in the day, has decided to join that party too.
But hey, now the topic's been broached. I mean, there's been about 4 billion articles written about how Spotify should become a label. Why shouldn't Apple Music become a music publisher? In both cases, it would surely cut out the middleman and make life a lot easier.
Yeah, everyone wants the streaming services to start signing artists and songwriters directly, the argument being that all these services are loss-making, their biggest cost is the 70% plus of revenue that they have to hand over every month to the record companies and the music publishers and the collecting societies.
And they could just be handing that to themselves.
Why not sign artists and songwriters direct? Cut out the old school music industry. We don't need record companies, we don't need music publishers. Get the artists on board direct and then everything will be fine. And the cost of content will be cheaper and everyone will go into profit and everything will be lovely. So as you say, there have been many articles about that in recent years, particularly talking about Spotify becoming a record company or maybe Apple becoming a record company. Even that, I don't think is going to happen. It is true. I've met people at the streaming services, particularly Spotify, who are in artist relations, who quite like the idea of doing that, of having direct deals with artists, so they no longer have a label between them and the artists. And that is something that they would like to do. Although the Spotify top god and Troy Carter, who is sort of their main guy when talking to artists and managers, have always been adamant that that is not on their agenda. It certainly wasn't a proposal that was in their documentation around the direct listing. And I think if you're a streaming company in an incredibly risky business like streaming, and you need to find other ways to make money, why would you consider going into the record label business, another incredibly risky business?
Which is currently mostly reliant on the other risky business for its revenue.
I don't think that by putting two risky businesses together, that particularly creates a solution. And when it comes to signing artists, I mean, you have to do one of two things. You either sign superstar artists, but those deals are incredibly expensive. Or you sign new artists, where you can get them with a much lower investment. But that's an incredibly risky investment. And people say, oh, well, Spotify have all the data and they have the marketing channels. And that is true. They would have an advantage in that domain. But even so, you can sign artists and do everything right and it still just not work. and even the best labels, you've got to sign a few artists to find the one who really goes big. Plus, of course, another thing we know is when you look at the stats on the streaming services, catalogue is becoming an ever increasingly big part of consumption. Way more catalogue is being consumed on streaming as was on downloads, and certainly as was in the physical domain. So even if Spotify did set up a label and did have the 10 biggest artists of the moment on its roster, that doesn't help it access any of the other content it needs any cheaper. So I don't see Spotify becoming a label at any point in the future.
No, and then becoming a publisher, that's even less useful, really, because song rights are even more complicated than recording rights. And doing your deals, they wouldn't be able to exclude the collecting societies from the equation, even if they became a publisher themselves. So they still have to hand money over to the collecting society. The money would still be going out of the system, even if some of it came back in. It just makes things quite messy.
Yeah, song rights are really complicated, and actually the publishers aren't as powerful as everyone thinks. In continental Europe, not at all. The collecting societies do the deals in their entirety. It is true with the Anglo-American repertoire that the big publishers now do direct deals in streaming. But outside of the US, they still have to involve PRS in that deal, because a stream exploits the performing rights as well as the mechanical rights in the copyright. And outside of the US, when the performing rights are being exploited, you cannot cut the PRS out of the equation. I mean, the songwriter could pull out of PRS entirely, but why would you do that? You need the radio income and the live income and all of that. They could pull their digital rights out, but then you'd have to do direct deals with all of the other streaming services and you would lose money. And even in the US, where BMI and ASCAP, the big collecting societies, don't have the exclusive rights that their counterparts do elsewhere in the world, oh, it's still so complicated. And that's before you get into co-rights. Actually, you'd sign a songwriter, but the chances are the hits they were writing, there would be four other writers on them. So you would only have 20% of the rights. No streaming service wants to get into the business of music publishing. So, yeah, I guess that's why Apple Music is not getting into the business of music publishing, which was this week's big news.
Tune into future episodes of Setlist to hear about more industries that Apple Music is not getting into. Just quickly, time for a bit of news in brief now. Daniel Ek has conceded that Spotify's hate content policies were not implemented very well.
Yes, the debate continues around Spotify's decision to remove music that it considers to either be hateful in itself, or perhaps more controversially, has been created by people accused of hateful conduct. We talked about that briefly on last week's set list, although the actual policy came into effect while we were off doing Great Escape stuff. It continues to be that some people have said, well done, Spotify, but hey, this is just the start. Here are the other 4,009 artists we would like to see removed from your service. Other people are saying, okay, your initial targets were people like R. Kelly. R. Kelly has been accused of a lot of hateful conduct, but never actually convicted in court. Should you be, in essence, being judge and jury on those allegations? So it has proved controversial. And yeah, Daniel Ek was speaking at a tech conference organized by Recode, and that topic was brought up, and he conceded that perhaps they could have introduced and communicated those policies in a better way. But they are just very tricky policies. I'm not sure what they could have done to avoid controversy. I suppose
Well, he's now saying they're going to consult with various different campaigners and labels and other interested parties. Surely that's the starting point before you introduce the policy. You don't kind of introduce a policy and then go, right, and now let's write the policy based on this draft we've published.
But when they published the policy, they name-checked all the organisations they had already been talking to. But perhaps all those organisations were on one side of the debate, possibly, may have been part of the issue. So, yeah, that story continues to evolve, I guess.
Nick Grimshaw and Greg James are swapping shows at Radio 1.
Yeah, Radio 1. Do you remember Radio 1?
I've heard of it.
So Nick Grimshaw has been presenting the Radio 1 breakfast show for 6 years, nearly.
A record-breaking run.
A record-breaking run, said the press release, although the record he's broken is as second longest stint on the Radio 1 breakfast show, which surely doesn't count as a record.
Second is a record. Everyone knows that.
So after nearly 6 years of getting up really early in the morning to go and play some records to young people who don't listen to the radio, Nick Grimshaw has decided to stand down from that show, but he's not leaving the station. He's taking over Drive Time, and Greg James, who presents Drive Time, is moving to the breakfast slot. This is all happening in the autumn. I guess some young people probably do listen to Radio 1 in the morning, because I think there are some parents who put Radio 1 on for the kids on the school run. So if any kids are actually listening to Radio 1, it probably is during the breakfast show slot, and they will get to listen to Greg James instead of Nick Grimshaw from later this year.
Lucky them. London buskers I'm going to accept contactless payments. So no more pretending you don't have any money as you pass them, because there's many ways to pay now.
Yeah, saying, really sorry, I haven't got any change won't work anymore.
Because no one has any change anymore. So that's why they're doing this.
You'll have to say, sorry, I've lost my debit card.
Which, and my phone and any other means with which I can pay.
Or your music's awful,
I think,
is another option.
Yeah, just say you're not enjoying it. So let's all just be honest.
I do sometimes quite enjoy buskers, but still don't give them any money.
Oh, you're a bad person. I always give them money.
To be fair, no, you don't.
No, that's not true.
Also, this is buskers on the London Underground.
Yeah.
And you don't really use the London Underground, because when you are in London, you tend to cycle.
Yeah, so you avoid the buskers.
To avoid the buskers. So this is a new initiative supported by the London Mayor, and they're working with a technology company. So buskers will have a little gadget next to their hat or violin case, whatever it is that people are throwing the money in, where people can tap their cards. And, well, the question is, how does the machine know how much money to take off the person with the card? So the busker will get to choose. I assume they'll have to put a sign up that says, I'm charging £2 every time you
put. Yeah.
I mean, that would be the risk. I mean, are there any safeguards on that? What if they say they're going to take £2 and then it turns out they took a grand off my card?
If you do it with the Apple Pay on your phone, say, it immediately comes up on your phone and tells you how much you spent. So if it said £2 and I tapped that and it came up and said you just spent £100, I think I might go and say something. Like, look, I wasn't even enjoying it that much.
I just felt guilty. But that's only if you're using Apple Pay or a smartphone-based payment
system.
Yeah,
but there's enough people, someone's going to notice pretty quickly that that's happening.
The other way would be for the tipper to also have an app on their phone, and then they could set the price. So they get every busker, I'm happy to give
a
pound.
No one would download that app. What are you talking about?
That is true. That is the slight flaw
in that
plan.
And the other
option
would be to everyone would have to crouch down and like tap in how much they wanted to pay.
And their PIN number.
Like 17p.
Hey, I've just bought something with my debit card for reasons I've never quite got to the bottom of. My personal debit card, I think because it's really old, although it can't be that old, it doesn't have contactless on it. It's weird because my business one does. So I can do contactless with my business card, but I can't with my personal card. That's my excuse.
Well, you're just going to walk over. My card's weird.
My card doesn't do contactless. In fact, I'll just tap it. I'll tap my card on the machine and be like, it's not working.
Or tap it and don't say anything.
It's always annoyed me that it's always annoyed me that my card doesn't have contactless. Not enough to phone the bank and ask them to send me one that works. So it's annoyed me in a way that I've not done anything about it. But hey, I now have an upside of having a debit card that doesn't do contactless. Or I can just charge all my busking tips to the company. One or the other.
Anyway, you'll find links to all of these stories and everything we've discussed this week at setlistpodcast.com. And finally, this week, the Michael Jackson estate has sued American TV network ABC and its parent company Disney over a documentary about the late King of Pop called The Last Days of Michael Jackson, which aired in May.
Did you watch it?
No.
Because it was on American telly.
Yeah.
That would be a good excuse for not watching it.
I'm not sure that doesn't sound like something I'd watch.
The Michael Jackson estate had already criticised this programme. Even before it aired, they were annoyed that they hadn't been consulted about the programme. I don't think it can be compulsory.
No.
When you're making a programme about Michael Jackson, you have to go and consult his estate. But they were a bit annoyed that this, in essence, unofficial documentary was airing. And at the time that they were critiquing it, before it had aired, they said, not only are we annoyed about this because we're not involved, we suspect they're going to use our intellectual property in this programme, and they did not get our permission to do so.
So having now seen the programme, because the estate did actually watch it, they've written up a list of all the copyrights that they reckon ABC infringed, and then filed that list with the LA courts in the form of a copyright infringement action. That list includes Michael Jackson's songs and music videos, concert footage, and extracts from the This Is It movie and a documentary the estate itself commissioned back in 2016.
Now, as we record this podcast, ABC have not commented on this lawsuit, but when the estate put out that statement pre-broadcast and ABC were asked about the intellectual property allegations, what they said to reporters at the time was, This is a news programme. It did sound, I haven't watched it, but it did sound like quite a tabloidy news programme with lots of sort of people who'd never met Michael Jackson just doing that classic pundit thing of like, oh, he was a singer, wasn't he? Oh, that controversy. Hey, look, all these paparazzi shots. It sounds like it was that sort of show. But what ABC are saying
sounds
was
good.
It was a news programme, and therefore we are confident that all of the extracts of other people's content that we have used is being used in a legal way, which therefore throws up an interesting copyright thing, because I assume what they're saying is that their use of Michael Jackson's songs and the clips from the shows and the This Is It movie and the documentary, I assume what they're saying is our use of all of that is fair use under American copyright law. American copyright law has this thing called fair use, which is where you can use copyright material without permission. And even in countries like the UK, where we don't have quite as wide a concept that allow you to use copyright material without permission, we have fair dealing, but it's a narrower concept. But we do have a news reporting copyright exception. So news reporting is something that sometimes is able to use copyright material without license, although quite what that means varies from country to country. And in the US, this notion of fair use tends to be quite ambiguous and vague. So if this gets to court, or indeed as far as ABC issuing a defence in court, then my assumption is there'll be an awful lot of talking about fair use. And now this was a news programme and it was all fine.
So that could be a very interesting case, and one, if it is one we'll come back to, I'm sure. But that's all we have time for this week. If you want to comment on, disagree with, or likely debate anything that we've discussed in this episode, you can get in touch with us via the social media. We're Setlist Pod on, you know, most places, or you can email us like in the olden days at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. Sitting in for Matt Peaty this week is Richard Power. The show is edited by Jason Wolf. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.